welcome, and thank you for tuning in, ladies and gentlemen, to the one and only Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik, and we have been going strong since 2006. We tackle many of the issues that we find to be of vital importance in these times in order for us to counter the one-sided view that we get in the mainstream and much of the alternative media. We go into new territory and find roads less traveled to reach new places and to blaze new trails, seeing things for what they are, as the world accepts lies and fabrications as reality. I mean, why stop now? This is what we've been doing for all this time, from the beginning. Now, as much of the alternative is more or less becoming mainstream, conspiracies and the exposure, for example, of the occult subtextual messages in the media is lifted forth by the alternative outlets, now working hand in glove together with the marketing departments in the industrial entertainment complex, unbeknownst to most, I would say. But, you know, why stop there when there's just so much more to be learned, right? Well, you can find us at redicecreations.com if you like what we do and want to hear more. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and Stitcher. Today we're speaking with Matt Forney. He is an author, journalist, and entrepreneur currently based in New York City. A native of Syracuse, he has lived in Canada as well as the Philippines and studied English and journalism at SUNY, Plattsburgh, and the University of Albany. His writing primarily focuses on masculinity, relations between men and women, literature, and American culture. Matt is a columnist for Return of Kings and Tacky Magazine and blogs regularly at his website, mattforney.com. He also writes for Reaction, Alternative Right, and many other sites. Additionally, he is the author of the Self-Help Guide, Confessions of an Online Hustler, and several other books. We'll mention those a bit later, but we'll begin to speak about men and the relationships with women. Hi, Matt. Thank you for coming on. Glad to have you here.
Thanks for bringing me on, Henrik. It's both a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you so much. Well, it's good to have with us someone here from the manosphere, right? You write for Reaction, Return of Kings, Tacky Mag, and many other sites as well. So when did you get started, Matt, as a way of kind of introducing you a bit? How did you get dragged into these topics?
Well, it's been a, I don't want to use the cliche long, strange journey, but I guess in many ways it was because, I first started my little intellectual journey on this, like maybe back in college around 07, 08 or so. I mean, I was always kind of a contrarian. Like I grew up in upstate New York and I went to a very, an academic scholarship to a very kind of prestigious in the area Catholic school, that was sort of steeped in the sort of left wing, social justice gospel. Like, for example, my high school had a local chapter of Amnesty International. So I sort of rebelled against that when I was a teenager by becoming a deliberate sort of, you know, cartoonish neo-con, right winger, but when I moved to college, I continued on this legitimate intellectual journey. I moved more into libertarianism and began reading, and I stumbled across the beginnings of the Manister, as it were, the Nascent men's rights movement and writings like that around 07, 08. I began blogging in 2009 when I graduated and moved into the workforce under the old website In Malathide, under the pen name Ferdinand Bartomeu. That site was around for about 3 years, and I started writing under my real name in 2012 just because I realized there was nothing really to lose anymore, and I wanted to make a break from the past and concentrate on such things. There was never really any sort of, you know, lightning moments. I mean, my enemies keep trying to psychoanalyze me, saying, like, oh, what kind of woman, who was the woman who broke your heart and made you such a misogynist? Yeah. It's like, no, it's just been one sort of slow movement from point A to point B to where I am today. I mean, it's just a slow journey of just realizing the truth and trying to refine my own thoughts about the world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was going to ask you now, so when was your bad relationship, Matt? You know, has to be that right now. But the men's rights movement, is it, would you say that it's simply a reaction to feminism or and coming as a response to that, or is it more than that behind it?
I'd say it began as an obvious response to the injustices put out through that feminists have instituted into the legal system in the U.S. and other countries, the injustices of child support. I mean, not child support per se, but onerous sort of debt prison type arrangements, what is colloquially called divorce rape, that kind of thing. I say it's morphed into something else because given the changing cultural attitudes in the U.S. and other Western countries, the men's rights movement and the greater manosphere cultural context is about in many ways a response to what is basically a deeply dysfunctional culture that has just gone down and completely penetrated and altered and for the worse relationships between men and women are basic fundamental aspects of our being. So it's become something much greater than it was originally, which was again a reaction to feminism and its and legitimate injustices.
Yeah, now I want to talk a little bit more later about what's going on here with the relationships, in your view, between men and women and how things have gotten to the state where it is today, which is horrible. And I would say primarily this is occurring in the West as well, actually. It's not really a huge movement abroad. I know that some people in the West, of course, is trying to take feminism abroad and force it on other countries and whatnot. But I wanted to ask you first a little bit about the background to feminism, if you've looked into that more. What some of the roots and origins of that is and how they've managed to gain so much ground and managed to push men back so much in society.
Well, I see it basically as, in many ways, the feminists and the feminists in the media and whatnot are basically pawns of corporate power and of the government power, because basically there are many different varieties of feminism. As you said, the current Western variety of feminism hasn't really taken root in countries that are outside of Western Europe, the U.S. and whatnot. But basically, the radical individualist doctrine of feminism encourages women and men to drive. It drives a wedge between them and is designed to turn them into sort of mindless consumers and mindless sort of, wards of the state. I saw this relatively recently, this sort of contrast. I spent several months living in the Philippines last year, a country where basically men and women are equal. In fact, the country has had two female presidents, women can go to college just fine. In fact, more women are going to college than men in the Philippines, stuff like that. They're, on paper, men and women are completely equal, yet the sort of combative, gender wars type feminism that is so prevalent in the West is completely absent there. And I see the big difference is that the Philippines, there's a very strong family unit, whereas in the West, in the U.S., I the only Western countries I've spent any time in are the U.S. and Canada, so I can't say for sure what the rest of the West is like. But in our cultural sphere, the family is basically non-existent. Everyone is an individual cultural as Michelle Houellebecq would put it, atomized individuals. Yeah. And those individuals are being manipulated by big corporations to become mindless consumers. They're manipulated by the government into becoming dependent on the government, which is why we see feminism. It's really an unholy conflagration of just. In many ways, feminism is basically just a stalking horse to enrich the powerly, as it were, at the expense of ordinary citizens. That's as it exists today. Any legitimate grievances that feminists may have had back in the 70s is basically gone now, which is why we got modern feminists agitating about, stuff like non-issues like man-spreading and man-slamming, because it's basically just a stalking horse for, making people into stupid, compliant, consumers.
Yeah, destroying relationships. It's yes, definitely an unholy alliance. I was being curious too as to why so many people don't kind of see that. If we look at some of the origins of even Rockefellers getting in there, sponsoring a lot of the early feminist movements, Betty Friedan and some of these other people that got started at the early days. However, having said that, though, do you think at the time, let's say 50s, whatever, is there any legitimacy in the arguments? Was there a need for some of the things that we've seen today, or do you think that it's all just bunk?
I think there's legitimacy in some respects. One thing we could say, there's a big misconception about the 1950s that it was some sort of uber-reactionary time, when in reality that period was, in fact, incredibly progressive. It was only superseded by the sexual revolution, what came after it. But basically, the whole nuclear family ideal that, in many ways, some sort of mainstream conservatives cling to, really has no traditionalist backing, the sort of 50s Leave It to Beaver type
thing.
Yeah,
exactly.
But at the same time, feminism became more of a, you know, and the liberalism became basically I can't find the exact word, but it's worse than it created a far worse problem, and we're still dealing with that problem. Like realistically, the legitimate problems of feminism by this point in Western countries have been solved. Rape has declined incredibly. Women have the full rights to vote. They work in the workplace. In fact, more women are going to college than men. Women are outperforming men in school. Women have a lower unemployment rate, at least in the U.S. Any legitimate issues have been solved, but the organizations that help fund this conflagration are not going to go away yesterday because, so they keep seeking new reasons to justify themselves, so it's morphed into a sort of, an outright hatred for men, engendering hatred in men for women, and just and further enriching the corporate government backers, who are the only people who really benefit nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say after the Second World War, everything was very much reformed and this kind of 50s, plastic version, because that's always something that's brought up today, of course. It kind of is an endless stream of movies about this and, from Mad Men to, Big Eyes to kind of show how this family was and to a certain extent, it is true. It was kind of a false construction to a certain extent that enabled, I think, this response to come out of it, which, as you say, created a much worse situation that we had before, where I think households were united, men and women were united. Those men and women who got together, they were probably in most cases fairly equal in their, let's say, politics. There was therefore a household vote as opposed to a one vote for the man and one vote for the woman, etc. But this shattering of the family is something which is of course tremendously detrimental today, and I think that this is also what has helped to shape not only women, but men into what they are today, kind of arrested development. A lot of boys grow up without their fathers, etc. It's just a string of bad consequences that this has had. That's how I see it anyway, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, like progressives and leftists try to hold up the 1950s as just sort of like dystopian time. I mean, yeah, it's problems to be sure, but people, the average family was much wealthier back then. A man could support his family just by his income, whereas nowadays both parents have to work just to keep the mortgage paid, that sort of thing. Poverty was much lower. Crime was much lower. Families were intact. It's like, okay, it has its problems, but why would any sane person try and claim that was some kind of dystopia where when the family unit was attacked and society was relatively working?
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's talk a bit more about radical individualism, because you'd think first, I thought this too, and I thought that this would be true in a country like, Sweden, where I'm from, for example, where we've seen very much of the same progression, for the lack of a better term. You'd think that a more kind of left-leaning, perhaps communitarian kind of people would be opposed to this kind of atomization that we've seen, but actually that's not true, and it seems like that this left-leaning political tendencies have really enabled the corporate powers, as you said before, to take over and kind of fulfill a role of what used to be a real sense of community in the past, and now we're very much no one is really dependent per se on each other. You can just go pick up anything you need. There's services for you. It really has shattered the old way of a more traditional community where you work together for something. And I'm really sad to see that this kind of is going out the window with this, new lifestyle that people are leading,
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, any claim the left had to being in favor of the working man and in favor of, should I say, collective and societal good has been, at least in the U.S., gone for at least 20 years now. For example, in the U.S., the left's advocacy for open borders and amnesty for legal aliens. Now, there's a good deal of that on the right as well. But bringing in more immigrants by simple virtue of the laws of supply and demand depresses the labor market. It makes it difficult for more people to get a job since it lowers wages. This is all proven fact.
Yeah.
And As Jim Goad wrote in the Redneck Manifesto, historically during the golden age of immigration in the U.S., the Ellis Island mythology, immigrants were, even back then, immigrants were brought in by large corporations specifically to break the power of unions and to depress wages and make workers more compliant with whatever big companies and corporations gave them. Whereas a sane left socialist policy, I mean, I'm not a socialist, but I have some left economic views, would support at least, at the very least, some kind of immigration restriction to help the native workers. But no, they keep bringing, they keep agitating to bring more people in. And it's the same thing with feminism and these other ideologies encouraging radical individualism. The left as it exists in the West has basically been the old economic left, this old sort of working class left has been supplanted by this sort of identity politics sort of individualist mentality, which, the only thing that matters is rights for oppressed groups, you know, right, like gay rights, rights for women, rights for transsexual, lesbian furries or whatever. That has no relevance to the average person. And again, the left is completely in favor of corporate power, as long as the corporate power, you know, says all the right code words and isn't racist or sexist or whatever.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, majority rights, that there's in the society that there's no rights for the people who, you know, actually are, you know, kind of the fundamental basis for the society. We have the same thing in Sweden. I don't mean to hammer that over and over again, but basically a scenario where, first of all, of course, if you're a man, you're out of the picture. But definitely, if you're a white man, it's even worse, you know. And there's no rights as a Swedish citizen under certain, you know, hate speech laws and protection in certain ways that all these, you know, quote minorities unquote have. I mean, Swedes are a minority in the world, and a lot of the immigrants that come into Sweden are definitely a majority globally speaking above us. But nonetheless, they managed to, you know, kind of force this kind of false image, I think, in a way, of, you know, who holds the power, for example, or who everyone else need to gang up on to suppress them to make sure that their power bases are broken down. But today, largely, these are inventions, in my view, Matt. These groups that they are attacking don't really hold that much power, no matter how much they try to pretend that this is the case, you know?
Oh, yeah, I mean, exactly the same thing in the U.S., you know, white men are held up as the apogee of privilege and the apogee of power. You know, I apparently possess mythical privilege over the women and minorities in the U.S. just by virtue of being male, being white. And I could have used some of that white male privilege when I was living in poverty a few years ago. Yeah. You know, I could have used that white male privilege when I had difficulty paying the bills. You know, it's completely absurd and speaks to just how divorced these people are from reality. And in many ways, they have an overpowering just hatred of, in many ways, men and of white people that just overpowers their complete common sense. I mean, it would be, it's just absolutely insane.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, exactly. What was it, Peggy McIntosh, the lady who came up with the privilege, white privilege term there, talked about that knapsack that you would, you had, you know, maps at your disposal and, you know, blank checks and credit cards and all kinds of things. I mean, these are, does anybody believe this? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like, in many ways, it's for like a form of magical, you know, cargo cult thinking. They think that, they think that wealth and like prestige and success comes from some sort of mythical, comes from basically being white or being male, whereas, you know, it's people who literally cannot understand that, you know, when you do see someone who's successful, you know, or someone who has money, they do so because they got through some kind of work. I mean, not everyone, obviously, but these people are so consumed by envy that they cannot think rationally. And the problem is that, you know, they now have the reins on us in the society. I mean,
yeah, I see what you're saying, Matt. You know, so would you say that this kind of the position a lot of people hold today is kind of a luxury, really? In other parts of the world, people are still kind of struggling and surviving, but for various reasons, we've attained a level where the engine of society, for the lack of a better term, has actually run very efficiently for a long time. Sure, there's been problems within it. I'm not denying that, but I'm saying that hard work, and there's a basis here where we've attained a certain level of success, if you will, survivally speaking, that we've now ended up in a situation where people have the luxury to sit around and whine on each other and bicker about these small little details and things like that. I kind of see it that we're actually kind of heading over that cliff right now, and the engine has been running so efficiently for such a long time that we haven't really noticed that it's like starting to shut down and things are starting to go downhill again. But by the time we do that, I think we're going to be in a lot of trouble. And I think that these luxuries that we've had in the West of developing these relationships, of complaining on each other, micro-detailing every little aspect of how we should live or what people think or, you know, these kinds of issues, could potentially go out the window by the time this machine kind of crashes, if you will. I don't know what your view on that is, Matt.
Well, I think in... I somewhat subscribe to Anonymous Conservative's view on this. He wrote a book a couple years ago called The Evolutionary Psychology Behind Politics. I may have gotten the title wrong there, maybe The Evolutionary Biology of Politics. So basically, the idea is that leftism and conservatism, broadly defined, are actually manifestations of two different mating strategies. Conservatives are case-selected. They favor smaller families, parental investment in children, and basically a society where that values meritocracy and hard work. Our selected individuals favor free resources, promiscuity, and just general lack of loyalty towards your in-group or anything. Like, the comparison would be towards like wolves versus rabbits. Wolves are operating small, tight-knit packs. They have a few offspring, but they spend a lot of parental investments in the raising said offspring. Very tight-knit. You know, wolves will be case-selected, whereas rabbits exist basically in a world of, you know, near-infinite resources. You know, if you're a rabbit, you eat grass. There's way more grass on this planet than all the rabbits will ever be able to eat. So
yeah.
When a rabbit encounters danger, they don't fight. They run away. So basically, what we're seeing is, as society has shifted towards being very wealthy, obscenely wealthy to the point where people can, no one in the society really understands the concept of struggle. In the U.S., even the poor people are fat. We have moved towards an R-selected sort of mating strategy where people have no loyalty to the country, have no loyalty to each other, have no loyalty to their families. That is basically how leftists operate. And they operate as and you can see this when you see leftists just outright going to stab their country in the back in many ways, or just playing two groups of case-selected wolves against each other, as we would see, for example, the recent dust-up between the New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and the NYPD.
Oh, yeah.
Playing two case-selected groups against each other in many ways. The thugs who... The ghetto thugs who, for better or for worse, have a loyalty to their in-group, which is, you know, the ghetto, and the city police. And as society becomes poorer, as resources become more scarce, which may well be happening in the next few years as the recession continues, we're going to see a big shift back to case-selected breeding and case-selected thinking. And maybe it could be already happening. I mean, with the midterm elections, we saw in the U.S., we saw the Democrats just absolutely trounced any, and particularly the Democrats who are running on, you know, feminist war on women type of themes, just get absolutely slaughtered. So we may be seeing a shift back to case-selected breeding. So I view it in many ways as just a manifestation of basically two competing strategies between conservatives and leftists. This individualism is basically a byproduct of wealth that is going to go away as our societies become poorer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So are we devoid from contact with nature? And again, I understand that we don't live in that kind of world right now. But it would be a good idea, I think, to still kind of have a grounding in reality and not becoming too isolated and too kind of shielded from some of the real forces in the world out there. Because I think if we manage to, and we could talk about this in any kind of other analogy, really, we could talk about it from a technological point of view, even where we develop into a certain area, let's say where mankind develop robotics to take care of certain services for us or think for us or machines that drives us, etc. At some point, if that tumbles, if that crashes, then we have a real potential danger of the survival of the entire species, because we would have people who are not capable of tending to the basic needs for survival. And I mean, it might be sounding like an exaggeration, but I'm really seeing that that's where this is heading if this continues, Matt.
Pretty much. I mean, basically, this goes to a problem of scale. Basically, Western countries are so large nowadays and so complex that basically no one can really see what their role in society is. And you can especially see this, the rise of dysfunctional behavior, particularly in big cities. The sort of combat dating that people complain about, the very strained relationships between men and women, the rise of sexual deviancy. It all happens the further away you get from a nature and a natural standpoint. Same things coming at a more basic level. Our bodies are we're unhealthier due to all the toxins in the water, due to our diets that are full of GMO laden food just absolutely frankenfood and whatnot. Testosterone levels have been dropping for the past few decades. Stuff like that. The further we get removed from our natural self, I mean, there are obviously a lot of good things about modern technology. I mean, you know, it enables us to live lives of relative comfort and do other things. But at the same time, as we completely deny our natural origins, we're becoming unhealthier, we're becoming less happy, we're becoming more miserable, and we're just seeing the outright, you know, rise of we're going completely insane as a society as a result.
I can't do anything else but agree. I see this all over, unfortunately. What do you think the response to some of this should be? It's very difficult. I'm talking with Lana and the other day, and we were talking about what to do and how to act within such a society, because in some cases, if you do try to set something out completely outside of it, we've seen examples like Waco in the past. We even had one event now down in Texas where actually a group of secessionists, they even had like their own currency or whatever, but the feds obviously moved in predictably as a show of force and broke everything up. I don't know how many, I haven't followed up on the story since, but probably people would end up in jail, or they'll be labeled as terrorists or something like that for simply trying to kind of disconnect in a good way from this society. And I think that's a good idea, but it might be even too prematurely. We talked about it and we said, maybe it's like the Titanic, right? That's on the way down. It's sinking. What we need to do is basically have I think someone else mentioned this actually on the show, so I don't want to steal this analogy here, but they said, you know, throw the life rafts in the water and stand on the Titanic still while it's, up above the surface and point in the right direction and say that there is a way off the boat. But we have to be careful about the timing, of course, so we don't do it too quick and we can't do it too late either. I don't know. Well, how do you view this, Matt?
I'd say it's actually a perfect analogy because, frankly, like you said, these sort of like secessionist moves really don't end up working because the feds will come in, or because in many ways a number of the people who start these projects tend to be dysfunctional in their own way. So I'd really say the best solution is an individual one, and a small scale collective one. Try to live the best life, the healthiest life, the most normal life for yourself and for your family and for those close to you. Try and spread the truth, but don't be too pushy about it. And basically, try to point people in the right direction. Because I have a personal model. Basically, I don't try to evangelize. If someone comes to me and is interested in like hearing what I have to say, I'll tell them. But I don't offer my opinions to people who don't ask for them, for the simple reason that most people are not prepared for it, and many people will just violently react when you criticize. People are so very invested in many of the lies of society that they will react violently if you basically tear them down. It's like it's like that section from The Matrix where Morpheus is telling Neo that many of the people in The Matrix are so dependent on The Matrix that even if you tell them the truth, they'll still defend The Matrix because it would otherwise completely destroy the way they view the world. So I can say the only real viable solution at this point is an individual solution. Be the best person you can be and try and steer your loved ones in the right direction. But don't push it, because people have to want to join this on this of their own free will. You can't force that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it's about leading by example. And as things crumble, I think you'll have a lot of people looking around to other things that's working. And if there are people that actually are still operating and working with some level of sanity still, they're going to ask, what are you doing? You know, how does that work? You know, So that's a good idea. Now, ultimately, do you think that this is something that people will have to experience as opposed to kind of a theoretical indoctrination that people get today through, I would say, obviously school, education, right? But I would also say media, entertainment media. We've been doing a lot of analysis on Red Eyes the last few years here, and we have a tremendous amount of videos that we're actually still working on just analyzing, you know, big movies and television shows and things like this. And I'm just amazed at the level of, in some cases, very blatant, but in other cases, very subtle and subversive kind of subtextual propaganda that's weaved into our modern cultural discourse of popular culture, you know?
I think it works in both directions in that, yes, it's obvious that media is trying to manipulate people, but at the same time, there's a certain market for it, and the both of them feed back into each other. Like, for example, one popular example in the manosphere is basically how, for example, the show Sex and the City many ways warped the minds of, should I say, early late Gen X and early millennial women by sort of normalizing sexual promiscuity and that sort of, you know, materialistic lifestyle and making it seem normal. Now, if a TV network had tried to put a show like Sex and the City on in 1968, it would not even have gotten greenlit. It would have been absolutely rejected.
Yeah.
But by the time 1998 rolled around, the greater culture had sort of degenerated to the point where something like that is acceptable, and you can see the sort of same feedback loop in pretty much anything else, like. The same shows in like shows like Will and Grace in the 90s that sort of normalized the homosexuality. If you try to put that sort of stuff up even 10 years before, you would have gotten a violent reaction from just about every quarter. But at the same time, those shows do help to soften up the minds of those who watch them to the point where, again, we see a continuing slippery slope towards now all of a sudden. Transsexuality has become a huge thing in the past 5 years. That just came out of nowhere due to normalization that occurred in the mid-aughts with I forget the name of the movie, Transamerica, and there was other stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
We see other paraphilias and other weird degenerate behaviors being normalized, and shows like Girls on HBO. So it's a feedback loop, whereas the media is obviously manipulating people, but at the same time, there's a certain sort of, you know, degenerate impulse in the people that consume this entertainment and continues the sort of cycle going downwards.
Yeah, I actually came across the article. Somebody wrote about it. I think it was on the degenerate website Gawker. They wrote about the Anilingus scene in Girls, you know.
And I was
amazed about the analysis that these people did about rimming, as they call it, and various techniques to how to go about and do this and all kinds of things, right? But it's quite remarkable how they do this kind of it's two steps forward where it's extremely shocking, right? All the media is writing about it. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe it. And then the media takes one step back and then people are, okay, well, you know, so the next show that comes out, at least it wasn't that shocking, right? But they've still maintained that one step forward. And then, of course, a couple of months later, 6 months later, another two step forward, everyone's writing, shocked about things. Oh my God. I'm just wondering if this kind of keeps up. I wonder what's the next level to this is going to be. I mean, is it pedophilia, bestiality? Because it feels like there's a kind of innate in this kind of way of looking at things. There's always have to be something new, right? A new exciting thing that is launched. Since you're so anti-traditionalist, you can't just kind of remain in a position where you tell timeless stories and eternal, you know, appeal to eternal archetypes and things like this. It has to be something new all the time. So what's the next step in this, do you think?
Well, we've seen that transsexuality is pretty much being normalized across the board. I think the turning point on that one was last year when I think that the star of Orange and the New Black, Laverne Cox, a transsexual black woman, was featured on the front cover, and it was a big feature article about, you know, the new frontier of civil rights. So that's being normalized right here. We may see probably some form of, I'm guessing. I've seen some documents that suggest that pedophilia may be the next one, in the sense that what happens is that when these things first start, they don't immediately, it's like slow boiling a frog. They don't immediately hit you with the hard degenerate stuff. They'll soften you up first by dunking the frog in lukewarm water. In this particular case of, say, pedophilia, at least in the U.S., what I see happening is that The left will agitate for the relaxation of sex offender laws. Now, don't get me wrong. There's a certain perversity to the way the America handles sex offenders. Instead of say executing them straight out or just throwing them in jail for the rest of their lives, if we do consider pedophilia to be an incurable medical condition and pedophiles to be a dangerous society, is that we let them out in society, but we purely strip them by putting them on the registry of being able to be gainfully employed or otherwise have semi-normal lives. So what I see is the left's going to penetrate by claiming that this is somehow unjust, and then what will happen after that is then they'll start trying to legitimize pedophilia by saying, well, you know, it's just sex, you know. At least the little kids are still alive, you know. And from there, they keep slowly cooking the frog in lukewarm water until eventually the frog is dead and is cooked and didn't even feel it happening. So, but I do believe that with the declining economy, this is again only possible because our society is so wealthy. As the economy continues to decline, this sort of mentality is going to break down because people, you really can only obsess over stuff like this, transsexuality and other deviancies in a society that is wealthy. When most people are unemployed or underemployed and incapable of supporting themselves, when there's basically no economic future for many young people, we're going to see a hard shift away against this degeneracy and towards, should I say, normality. This has happened in societies throughout history, and we're just repeating the cycle.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was thinking about that too. I think we've seen these things before. They've risen and fallen, and then of course something goes back to some level of normality. For various reasons, it just crashes and tumbles. Some people speculate this is what we saw with Rome, and I think one difference now though is that the cycles are much quicker. We have technology, communication, transport, everything is much quicker. So I think both the fall and the rise is something that's going to be way quicker than it was, you know, 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago, right?
I mean, we can even go back to like world mythology and whatnot. For example, I'm not a Christian, but I do believe that the Bible contains a lot of truth in it. You see, when you see stories like Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, if you read, you know, don't read stuff like that literally. Like whatever, if Sodom or Gomorrah actually existed, you know, they were probably destroyed by just the degeneracy levels got to the point where they were either torn apart by their own internal friction, or they got conquered by outsiders that were not degenerate. Again, we saw the same thing happen to Rome, the invasion of the barbarians. We saw in many ways the rise and fall of various, you know, civilizations in the Middle Ages, the rise of Islam in the Middle Ages, and then it fell apart due to its own degeneracy, the Ottoman Empire, the various empires of Europe immolated in World War II, and now we're going to see the same thing happen to the U.S. and its satellite states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you mentioned before that there kind of is a desire to make certain things normal when it comes to, let's say, pedophilia as a way of kind of accepting people, but, you know, nonetheless have them on the list. I don't think yet we're going to see anything that accepts it. Well, there's two takes to that. One is the reaction, I guess, in England to someone like Jimmy Savile, for example. There's another. Mm-hmm. Was it even Alan Dershowitz now was involved in this? There's a number of these people. There are the royal circles, you know, Prince Andrew and a couple of other people. Jeffrey Epstein has been dragged into these kinds of things. But on the other hand, if we look at something like Rotherham in England, for example, where also there was a case of pedophilia, underage girls, etc., there no one said anything, right? No one voiced any kind of concern for how many years was it? Was it like
something like 15
years? Absolutely unbelievable, you know. And I'm not saying that that's a sign of us accepting pedophilia, but it's a case of picking and choosing those kinds of battles to point out because certain things seems to trump other cases. So in this case of Rotherham and later in Halifax here too that came out, it's an issue of if you point that out, then you're a racist, right? So let's avoid it. But if it's the other case with Jimmy Savile and these kinds of issues, then it's fine to bring it up and beat it all over. And it should be brought up, of course. I'm not saying that. It should be exposed because it's absolutely horrible, you know. But it's kind of a pick and choose in the hierarchy of those you want to attack, it seems like, right?
Yeah, I mean when the Rotherham scandal first broke, I sort of made a cruel joke, like, part of the reason the authorities probably ignored the grooming and pedophilia was that they were they're probably doing similar things themselves. But like we're seeing like this sort of the normalization again. We're in the very very early stages of the frog being cooked. Like right now, society still has difficulty accepting transsexuality. Like that's been foisted down our throats altogether. And the fact that there's some resistance to that idea, like. At the end of the day, I believe that, you know, people should be allowed to do whatever they want, but it's never that simple. Like, when it comes to when the left tries to foist various sorts of, you know, degeneracies on us, well, they always start out with, like, well, it's blah, 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 you don't have the right to tell people how to live. That's how it begins. And then that's how it began with gay rights. And now in the year 2015, we have basically, if you don't accept gay rights, you're a horrible, racist, homophobe, and you should be exiled from polite society. It never ends with tolerance. It eventually becomes you have to accept this or else we will destroy you. And the same pattern repeats itself again and again and again. So the left always uses tolerance as basically a facade. It's never about tolerance. It's about ramming these viewpoints down everyone's throats.
Yeah, repressive tolerance. Herbert Marcuse, right out of Rules for Radicals. Was it Rules for Radicals? No, that was Saul Alinsky. Sorry, it was another book. I forget which one. It was called Repressive Tolerance. That was this paper or book was called, and it was all about basically one-way tolerance of and it's kind of circular logic, because if you do say something like, well, you know, you're a hater, so we won't tolerate you, but then it's like, well, but you're hating me now for my opinion, so aren't you on the same level? It's like, no, it doesn't apply. So it's a one-way street, and that's where we're at right now, and there's no kind of reasoning, I guess, with these people. It's just a you know, they hate you for what you are and who you are, but then in return they expect you to love them, of course, right?
Yeah, it's like where we get to the situation now in the U.S. where, like, say, every month or so there's a story of a Christian baker getting sued because they refuse to make a gay wedding cake, you know? Tolerance only works one way. You have to tolerate them, but they don't have to tolerate you. And the other thing I noticed is that basically as they grow in power, the left gradually abandons any sort of logical argument. Like 10 years ago, the argument for gay marriage and gay rights was that, you know, love shouldn't be constrained by what genitalia you happen to have or who happen to love. You know, love is blind, that sort of thing. You know, it's sort of nice. Now it's basically they don't even bother arguing. It's basically to the point where there is no argument. If you don't accept gay marriage, there's something wrong with you medically. It all begins in the same way. Like again, the frog being boiled in the pot. You know, on the issue of gays, and you know, I'm not. If people want to be homosexual, that's their business. But it's like, you know, it's one thing to do something and engage in a lifestyle. It's another thing to expect everyone to pat you on the back and tell you that you're such a good person for doing it, which is basically what the left always wants to do.
Yeah.
They never want tolerance. They want basically people to accept them and praise them for whatever they happen to do, no matter how disgusting or just outright wrong it is.
So is this used as a tool, you think, politically? They use these various victim groups now in our society to... I see it as a method as well to clamp down on free speech, to bring even in more control, more surveillance of trying to censor things and opinions online. I mean, these are the real thought criminals now in our society that are starting to pop up, and they're trying to bring in real measures to shut these people down, you know?
Oh, yeah. And again, this works into basically how feminism was in many ways a creation, if not a creation, but... corporations and corporate power and the wealthy elite benefited from feminism. They benefit from this sort of identity politics stuff too, because it's all about turning people into mindless consumers. Instead of encouraging people towards, you know, forming families and sacrificing for the good of community, it's all about buy more stuff. Buy stuff to identify whatever victim group you are. Vote as a bloc and demand these identity politics and demand these special rights, all the while you're getting your pockets picked by big corporations. You're getting ripped off. You're getting ripped off when it comes to wages. You're getting ripped off when inflation inflates your prices beyond your wages. You're getting taxed to death. It's basically just as we keep going back to the radical individualism, it benefits the power elite at the expense of everybody else. And all these identity politics groups, gay rights, transsexual rights, feminists, whatever, minorities, they don't see this. They're so busy clamoring for their special rights, for their little pat on the back, telling them about what a good people they are. They don't realize that they're being robbed blind out of the other end.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's okay. You can have pride if you're, you know, homosexual, or if you're black or Asian and all that, perfectly fine, celebrate your heritage. But if you have pride in your people as a white person, if you're proud as a European that wants to preserve your traditions and your culture and your people, your language, you know, all of that, you're, of course, ousted as a hateful Nazi who wants to, you know, gas everyone that they don't like, etc. And this is done so that you'll become a pariah, as you said before, as a method to kind of have you socially ousted, to eventually maybe leading to you being fired from your job and things like this. So it's really, we're seeing a huge reversal here. They've really set it up in such a way that we sure know who their enemies are and what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. Very clear these days.
Yeah. Another aspect to it, at least when it comes to the more the issue of gender politics and men versus women, is that there's a really growing streak of Puritanism among the left. And I mean Puritanism in its original, in its real idea, like the left used to use Puritan as an insult for anyone who was sexually conservative or not in favor of degeneracy. But now we see in the case of, say, all these sort of the rape hysteria and the just outright smearing of anyone, any man who may have potentially raped a woman or just, you know, disrespected a woman in some fashion. The term I used for it in a recent Tacky Mag article is I-McCarthyism. Basically, the setting false, unsubstantiated, ridiculous accusations to people with the intent of destroying their public reputations, because there's no higher court of appeal in the court of public opinion. You just when someone accuses you of something, all of a sudden everyone dogpiles through the power of Twitter. All these sort of clickbait sewers like Gawker and BuzzFeed will pile on with their own articles. It's very literally the definition of a witch hunt, and it's motivated by basically, in many ways, The technological generation, the individualism, has created a generation of women and a generation of identity politics groups that inherently loathe their own beings. They're miserable, and they try to enforce their misery on everybody else. So I see it basically as an outgrowth, not just of, you know, a desire to shut down free speech and a desire to, you know, enforce, sort of say, authoritarianism on people, but it's just an outgrowth of these people's defective psychology. They're miserable, and they're trying to make everyone else miserable, and they're using, you know, social media and the regular media to enforce their misery on everybody else.
Well, exactly. It's crab mentality, right? Making sure that no crabs get out of the bucket. They pull each other down instead of helping each other out. And if it's that kind of mentality, if I can't have it, right, no one will. So if it's and you can apply that in any case. But I wanted to just return to one point here. We're going to take a break here shortly, but I wanted to get another thing by here. It's really a pick-and-choose kind of scenario, too, when it comes to the rape issue, for example, cherry-picking, right? Because you wrote a good article on returnofkings.com, why the feminists were actually ignoring the violent gang rape of, and she's a porn star, by the way, by Cythera. What was her name?
Cythera. Yeah.
Okay.
She's retired now. She's married and she has a family. Three thugs invaded her home and violently gang raped her and overpowered her husband. And there was, and for all the feminists who claim they care about rape and claim that we have, this society is a rape culture, they completely ignored her story. Meanwhile, they'll focus on someone like, say, Emma Sulkowitz, the Columbia student who's dragging a mattress around campus, claiming until her quote unquote rapist gets expelled, even though she already took it to the campus tribunal, and they cleared her quote unquote rapist of charges under the lowest possible standard of proof. Even in the lowest standard of proof that this girl was not raped, but she's still trying to. But the media is promoting her. They promote, for example, and they promote the Rolling Stone UVA rape hoax, but they ignore legitimate victims because they don't fit the script. They don't they can't help the left advance their agenda.
Yeah, wasn't it? I think even the purported raper, abuser there of Emma Sulkowitz, he even said that he was innocent. I think it took over a year or something for her to come to a conclusion that she actually was raped or something, right?
Yeah, something like that. And again, he's Looking at the basic facts of what she said about him, like, basically, they had consensual sex. It's just that her problem was that after she regretted it because he didn't give her the attention she wanted or something. In, like, you know, at decades past, you know, having a bad sexual encounter, you know, people would just tell you to suck it up and move on, or anyone would suck it up and move on. But because, in many ways, due to radical individualism, feminism, technology, and the atomization of society, people these days, women in particular, are uncomfortable with their own bodies, they're uncomfortable dealing with the opposite sex, they're uncomfortable with social interaction, and they've been trained by the media to view men as an oppressor and an enemy. And so this girl thinks, and tries to convince herself that, oh, I was raped, and takes this, and when even the professional rape tribunals on campus, who basically exist to do stuff like this, even they don't support her, she basically takes to the court of public opinion, and all these media people dogpile and support her, and without any regard to how ridiculous the story is.
Yeah, it's absolutely absurd. We'll pick up and talk more about that here after a short break. We're going to take a short break in a little while, but I wanted to get out some of your websites, Matt. You do have a couple of books out there I want you to mention, and feel free to mention some of the sites that you write for as well as a plug if you want to.
Well, I blog mainly at my website, mattforney.com. I don't blog there as much anymore because I write for other sites, but I have an archive of my writing there going all the way back to when I first started the site 3 years ago. So go check out mattforney.com. My books, I've written several books, such as Confessions of an Online Hustler, which is about a debunking of, so to say, make money online scammers. It's my experience in monetizing your skills and how to make and how to make a living from your skills online, which is what I do for a living now. I don't have a day. This is my day job. You can get that as well as my other books at mattforneybooks.com, as well as Amazon and other sites. Additionally, I also write a weekly column for Return of Kings, returnofkings.com. I am a monthly contributor to Tacky's magazine, tackymag.com, and I also write for Reaction, which is a new gaming website from Roosh, the publisher of Return of Kings. That is reaction.com, reaxxion.com. And I'm also an occasional contributor to Alternative Right, which I believe alternative-right.blogspot.com. That's where you can find me on the internet. And also I do a weekly podcast, soundcloud.com/Matt Forney Show. I'm also on YouTube and Twitter and all the other stuff.
All right, very good, folks. There you have it. We're going to have the links up that Matt mentioned, of course. Do check out mattforneybooks.com for more on his three titles that he has there for you right now. Yeah, we'll take a short break here, guys, ladies and gentlemen. And, of course, Matt, stay with us. We'll be right back with more.
Let's write.
second hour, Matt details the Sexodus, called Men Going Their Own Way, MGTOW, a wing-up movement spawned from a basically unhealthy reaction to society by men who are unable to deal with some of the conflicts and challenges of life, ultimately brought about by the rise of gender confusion, primarily in the West. We look at the isolating effects of technology, the modern tribulations of our schizophrenic society, and the quest to numb the pain of existence. Later, we ponder the hive mind of the social justice warriors and artificially created problems that are leading towards the slippery slope of censorship. And later, we break down the antisocial nature of the younger generations, pornography's demoralizing effects on our culture, and the hater mentality that highlights how divorced people are from the natural human state. Don't miss the second hour, ladies and gentlemen. Much more is coming up. An interesting and a valuable conversation on another very pressing issue, if you ask me. You can sign up for a membership with us and continue to listen to the second hour and all of our previous shows. On redicemembers.com, you have all the details. It's only €5 per month. And the euro is kind of weak against the dollar right now as well, which is, of course, a bummer for us in Europe. But it's great if you're in the U.S. I think they're close to equal at the time of this program being recorded anyway. So it's about $5 per month. We have 3-month subscriptions up to 2 years available. And the 3-month is both recurring and non-recurring, whatever you prefer there. Yeah, so please have a look in our archives. We have a lot for you there. You'll get instant and full access when you sign up, of course, getting close to 1,000 programs, plus videos, TV episodes, and newer insight videos as well. And also, we have some great shows coming up, too, that you don't want to miss, with Rebecca Roth on 9/11, very interesting show. We have E. Michael Jones, Marion Van Court, Joshua Blakeney, Vasily Lupash, and Alexander Dugin. That shall be an interesting program. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back with more. Thank you so much for listening and for staying with us. We love your support. We'll talk to you soon.